Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Skinny One trade deal is signed. Bank earnings rolling in, markets rallying following the bullish trend. And our guest today is Nolan Langford of Left Brain Research. All this and much more on episode number 645 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I'm your host of the show, as well as the co-host of DH Unplugged each and every week on Tuesdays. We record that and actually stream that live at 9 p.m. at night. Myself and John C. Dvorak do that every week, breaking down the news, looking at the other side of what's really happening. So you can really check out the difference. And if you haven't heard DH Unplugged, quite different show than the Disciplined Investor. But I want to thank you for listening. Also, I want to thank you because I just saw some fantastic reviews of the show on Apple Podcasts. You know, you can put your review of the show on there. Some great feedback, and listeners really provided an incredible amount of information, and that really helps shape the show because we get these insights into what you want to hear, who you think was a good guest, bad guest, when you think I'm on the right track, when you think I'm off it. So keep on doing it. Keep on providing those reviews and keeping it up. And if you haven't done so already, please do go there and give us a review. If you've done one maybe sometime in the past, maybe a couple of years back, well, you can go over and do it again, update it, and tell us how we're doing. I really do appreciate that. So the big news of the week, I guess we really have to talk about the trade deal. Because it was signed, finally. Lots of pomp and circumstance. President Trump was out there, up on the podium, calling out a lot of people in the audience and having them stand up and take a congratulatory bow and telling everybody how great they are, how great he is, of course. And there was the Chinese delegation there as well, all in front of this trade deal signing ceremony. Again, a lot of camera action. Everybody's were eyes glued to this. Well, we knew it was going to happen. They said they were going to sign it. Not like anything was going to all of a sudden change with that. But the first half hour, 45 minutes of this was all about introducing all these senators and people and parties that were involved with the process and giving them the big thumbs up. But finally, we got to the two sides meeting, and therefore we finally got the trade deal signed. And then we got, after that, the text, about 91 pages. The first, I would say, 20 pages were all the preambles and discussions about what if and what was this party going to do and the responsibilities of the other party. It went through all that. Then there was pages upon pages about what tariffs were still on the various sectors of Chinese goods that were going to see continued 25% or the 15%, whatever the particular tariff was, that will stay on until such time as the trade deal part two would be possibly negotiated, signed. So one of the really big things in there, there's a couple of lines in terms of what happens if maybe there's a dispute or possibly some kind of resolution needs to be released because something's unclear. One of the sides isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing. And there's a line in there talking about if either side has not acted in good faith, then either of the parties can provide written notice to essentially just simply withdraw from the deal. Now, of course, it has to go through the dispute process, but it's not really clear inside of there if either side needs to go through the entire process or just has the ability to say, you know what, the hell with this. This isn't working for us. We're out. We're done. Or, hey, you were supposed to be buying this much goods from agriculture and you fell short of it. And if you don't do so, well, we're going to maybe apply some tariffs possibly or do something that maybe is a problem. Well, the other side can say, well, that's not really what's happening. We did our best in good faith. The other party would say, well, no, you haven't done so. Rip the whole deal up. So there's a major out clause that probably was the reason why both sides were able to get together and sign this, because really, I think this whole deal is a lot more ceremonial than anything else. It was a great opportunity to get some initial phases kind of worked out, but at the same time, a really good timing politically for the markets and for both sides to save some face. Now, what else was inside of this trade deal that kind of wowed us? I don't think much. I mean, I think it was really what we thought it would be. There were some additional requirements on China for buying goods, manufactured goods, and agricultural products. There were some hints around technology and other protections in there, and some openness for financial institutions to enter into China. And there was a few other goodies, but by no means was this the grand deal that we were talked about getting a year or so ago. The grand deal is going to be, I guess they're calling it phase two, or maybe three, or 2A, 2B, then three. And it's clearly the signing, the commitment, and the resolution of where we are today is definitely, there's no question about the fact that it's a step forward. It's going to create a calming factor for markets because we're going to be limiting the potential for escalation of any additional trade war and maybe tariffs, at least for some time. At least possibly until after the election. In fact, there's been some headlines, President Trump's been talking about that negotiations and discussions about the next part of this trade deal, which really deals with technology transfers and intellectual property rights and a variety of other issues regarding state-owned enterprises and how they're being supported by the Chinese government. All that are, first of all, major sticking points, areas that I don't think there's going to be a lot of progress made. But all of that is going to be, it seems to be underneath the, under wraps, so to speak, until after the election, because if we do so, we got a big win here for the phase one completion, and then the hope that if President Trump gets back in, the negotiations will then move to the next level. So I think it's being used as a pretty good political tactic, but yet I don't know how that's going to play out in terms of an actual trade deal. But again, it does cool the potential for headline risk because we're not going to see a lot of things happening for some time. Now, we also saw some earnings last week, the first week of earnings season with the financials setting the stage. And so far, pretty much things look okay. There was a couple of outliers like Morgan Stanley that upped their profitability outlook and the stock surged by 8%. So Bank of America and questionable net interest margins and profitability. We saw a variety of other banks come out. And I would say that if we were to sum it all up and take each one of them individually, put them together and look at both ends of the spectrum and kind of go to the middle and see where we are, I would say that we're pretty much on target. No surprises. Generally, the earnings came in pretty good. And as long as the banks have the yield curve working in their favor, I think that there's going to be a good potential that they'll do well over time, unless something really odd happens. And that could be a lot of different things. But essentially, when you look at the totality of what we've seen so far, it's pretty much like we've seen in past earnings seasons, where the first number of banks come out, things look okay. They, you know, kind of either move up initially on the print, then they come back a little bit, like we saw a couple of names like Bank of America, which came back straight down. Wells Fargo did not do too well, but then popped up a little bit the next day. Goldman Sachs was an area of concern in some levels. Citi did pretty good. I'm thinking of Wells Fargo, Bank of America. Who's the other one I was thinking of? We have to think about that. But again, generally speaking, there were some good numbers. Next week, we do have a lot more financials coming out, a spread of the financial sector entirely, a couple of names in technology like IBM coming out next week and a few others. And the following week is going to be pretty jam-packed with another round. And of course, we did see that markets hitting all-time highs once again on a nice move to the upside after all things look pretty good in terms of the CPI numbers and inflation, PPI numbers as well. We also saw a pretty good retail sales number. We saw that in terms of the retail sales, we did much better on the core number, but the National Federation of Retailers came out and showed that the retail sales for this holiday season were 4.1% above last year's, right on target for what they anticipated, but 4.1% up is a lot better than anticipated because there was supposedly, and you see this from some companies, a shortened holiday season as the days from Thanksgiving through, I think there was five less days or so between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So with that, we still saw a 4% increase or so on holiday sales, showing that the consumer is still doing pretty well. And that is the bedrock of everything for our economy right now, as we see that manufacturing continues to slow down. Factory orders are slowing down. We saw that on the wholesale side. We also saw that industrial production last week slowed more than it was anticipated. So we got this bifurcated economy right now where services and some areas are looking really good, whereas the manufacturing is starting to slow down and continue, well, not starting, but has been slowing down and in contraction territory and a recession. Let's face it, we have a manufacturing recession going on. Not really impacting the overall markets, but something to think about. Anyway, for now, how about we get to our guest, because I have a lot of questions for him. Let's get on with it. And our guest today is Nolan Langford. He's with Left Brain Investment Research. And Nolan's been working in the area of investments and finance for a number of years, decades actually. Launched his own RIA firm, Left Brain Wealth Management, and now a hedge fund, and now has an investment research firm. So I thought we'd get involved in a discussion about all sorts of areas, particularly related to active management in a time that, well, active management and passive management are going neck and neck, battle to battle. So Nolan, hey, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Hey, happy new year, my friend. Happy to be on the podcast and really excited to be with you today. So thanks for having me.
So there's a lot of questions I have. So let's start out with setting the table for a second here, because I have a question. So you have this hedge fund that you operate, right? That you started back in, 2016?
Correct. Yes, January 2016 it launched.
Okay, and you're mostly a bottoms-up fundamental analyst. That's how you do your thing to find the stocks out there. How many names do you cover?
Yeah, so we follow about 1,000 names every week that we're sort of interested in. And that is sort of the top of our funnel. And then we go through a process every week at the end of the week on Friday, my research assistant and I, to pare the list down. But initially, it starts with 1,000 names we look at every week. And then at the end of the week, we rank those names.
Okay. So you have this hedge fund that you're actively involved in. And you created this investment research platform or service in 2019, recently, right?
Correct. Yeah. January 2019 is when we started the actual development of it. And we've actually gone live with it to the public. And that started in Q4 of 2019.
So the question I have is, and maybe you can help me with this, because it seems to me that there could be some conflicts of interest in providing the research as well as investing. Now, while that is what we consider buy side research, right? Is there potential? It's got to be a potential for conflict, but how do you avoid the conflict?
That's correct. The potential is going to be there. Obviously, anytime you're investing your own capital and then giving investment recommendations or distributing your research, there's the potential for conflict. And so we try to avoid it wherever we can. We try to sort of minimize the conflict. We definitely make sure we have disclosures. But then we try to be upstanding citizens with what we do. You know, we're going through, we're trying to find ideas. We tell people right up front the type of companies, the type of opportunities we're looking for. And basically, we're just raising our hands when we find them to let our subscribers know that they exist and where they might find very attractive, profitable opportunities. The same one we scour the earth for, we share with our subscribers is what we're hoping to do. And so we do try to keep the conflicts really to a minimum, but we do disclose them.
So what if you have, you find this great stock, you've uncovered, you know, Great Stock Incorporated, and there you are, you're like, hey, I really like this stock. You do the research on it, and you say, well, that's something that I really want to concentrate some investments in for my hedge fund. And at the same time, you're obviously doing the research. What happens first? I mean, do you invest in it and then you send out a piece, or is it kind of concurrent, or where does that go?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. Very insightful on your side, and thanks for asking it. So generally, I should probably start with our process from the beginning instead of kind of starting at the end. But typically, we're going to go through this this research process that we do every week. And then we sort of take that data, we upload it into our own technology platform. We call it Jarvis, which is a web-based tool that's been programmed and custom coded and developed just for us and our likes. Mm-hmm. So we sort of upload the weekly 1 through 1,000 ranking up to our technology platform, Jarvis, who then does some sort of the other metrics and overlays with that data, and then re-ranks the list and really truncates the list to give us our best, our top handful of ideas. And so some weeks it could be 2 or 3 ideas, some weeks it could be more than a dozen. But when that list comes out, I actually take a look at it, Andrew. I go through the list and highlight names of interest out of that short list. And then what we do is send a note out to one of our analysts. So we have a team of analysts. Mm-hmm. And the first group of teams is going to do what we call a quick look, sort of a drive-by on a name. We'll put in 6 or 7 hours, do some preliminary work on the name. They'll produce a report. It comes back. And then we determine whether we want to do a deeper dive. And a deeper dive is something we call it a long form. It'll generally take our analysts the better part of 1 week to produce what we call a long form report. And then from that point, we'll determine whether or not it's appropriate name for us to take a position in, and if so, how. And the one business you didn't mention is our original business, which is our wealth management business, which mm-hmm. is how we got started mm-hmm. in the RIA business back in 2014. And that's where we manage money for individual accounts and individual clients throughout the country. And so something could be appropriate to purchase in a retail account. Or it could be appropriate to purchase in an institutional account and not a retail account. Every now and then, something is eligible or appropriate to be to be purchased in both type of accounts. And so that certainly helps with the conflicts. And then the other thing that we do is we do our research first. Obviously, the research has to come first.
I hope so.
Before we can determine.
I hope so.
a buy rating.
Right.
But we publish our reports, and we try to do them systematically always on a Friday night after the market closes uh-huh. is what we try to do, to try to not sort of disturb the flow of buy and sales and to move prices in the market and to give our research and our readers time to digest sort of what we're saying. So those things we do to as part of our process and to keep the conflicts at a minimum.
So, maybe I should have asked this first, but, you know, you're talking about your research process. I'm assuming that somewhere along the way, the idea for a name for your company came up and you chose left versus right brain. What's the history on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's better, easier to explain than it was to come up with. So you're right. At the very beginning, before the firm was founded, we knew we needed a good name, and I wanted to choose something that really reflected who we were and what we did, not something just parochial like Langford Investments or something. But the left side of the brain, Andrew, is the one that controls reason, logic, thought, calculation, and algorithms. And that's generally what we do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very appropriate to have as the name of the firm.
Yeah, versus the other side, would you be just simply looking at emotion, creativity, artistry, et cetera, right?
Yes, and I don't have a creative bone in my body.
You know, so it's interesting because one of the things, obviously, that you do with having a hedge fund and doing the research on a fundamental basis from a bottoms-up standpoint. By the way, for people who are wondering when I say the word bottoms-up, what does that mean? And you hear top-down. So bottoms-up is the idea of you're going to the core individual equity base or a bond or whatever the instrument is. You're looking at it on a one-by-one basis, building up from a fundamental, looking at the various financials, looking at the stability of the company, management, all of that that comes into play. You know, when people talk about ratios and they look at the PE or the PEG or whatever it is, that's a bottoms-up process when they're choosing one by one. Top-down is, hey, what's the overriding picture of the markets or, for example, the economic outlook? And, you know what, do we want to be in stocks or we want to be in bonds? And then you take a much larger position in, okay, where are we going to be? And then invest that way. So just to kind of clear that up a little, I think that was reasonable explanation, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So when we look at the bottoms up process, which is much different than what we see a lot of people doing with simply buying an index these days, right? Which is, you know, the thing to do, which is, hey, I'm just going to buy the S&P 500 because, well, it's cheaper and because, you know, why not? Nobody can beat the S&P 500 anyway. And, you know, on and on and on. But your thoughts on the whole active versus passive trends that are going on. Now, obviously, I know you're going to lean towards the active, but, you know, do you see something there that we need to be aware of or something that is sticking out that seems to be maybe troubling to you?
So I would agree with you that, you know, clearly we're on the sort of the active side of the argument. I think we have really good reasons for doing so. I think the passive thing came in and certainly made sense. And I think for a lot of investors, I think passively investing in some passive index, I think makes sense, particularly if you're a smaller investor, you know, have enough money to diversify, you really can't afford to work with an advisor, those sort of things. Even particularly if you're investing in a 401k or something, you can sort of set it and forget it. So I think that there's definitely uses for indices, for sure. The question comes up whether we are, the pendulum has swung too far. And, you know, if you think about extremes, what happens if everyone in the world indexes, right? So then you get into sort of issues. And the question is where we are in the pendulum swinging, whether we're past the middle. And I think so. Question is, you know, how far past and when do we swing back and what's the velocity? And so I think all of us active managers, I think, really have a time to shine. I think 2019 was a really good time to shine if you're active, particularly if you believe in concentration like we do as a firm. It gives you a chance to really distance yourself, and we've had really good success doing it. And if you think about, you know, really why you invest is to compound capital over long periods of time. And, you know, one of the ways that you can do it and really do well when you invest is to invest in securities that actually go up a lot in price. And so we do have this bifurcation of investors. You know, there's as a firm, you know, we say we help clients that are growing wealth, that are protecting wealth, you know, as well as growing wealth and building wealth. And if you're protecting wealth side, I think maybe the indexing is a really good way to sort of go about protecting what you have. You're never going to do worse than average. But if you're on the part where you're creating wealth or building wealth, then really what you'd like to do is you'd like appreciation. It happens in an attractive way. And one of the best ways to do that is to own individual securities. You know, even last year in 2019, you know, you have several securities that were up more than 100%. And typically you're not going to get that.
That was a little bit of an aberration. I mean, it isn't, not a little bit, it was an aberration. We don't see that often. But can I just stop you? I want to ask you something. I want to ask you about concentration.
Yes.
It's interesting because, which is the antithesis of diversification, obviously. So how do you deal with a situation where let's say that things are going along just swimmingly for your stock picks, right? And you're concentrated in a portfolio, which means I don't exactly know your weightings, but you got not, you know, you don't have a half a percent in every single stock that you're picking. You have a much greater amount of exposure, right?
Correct.
Which then lends you to have volatility, which then lends the potential for clients to get a little bit nervous from time to time. So obviously a training and an educational time spent with the client to understand what you're doing is important. But how do you deal with really, you know, when you have deep, for example, back in November, December 2018, where you have a concentrated portfolio, which may be taking a quite a beating during certain periods. How do you deal with that from a from your standpoint as an advisor, manager, you know, investment expert? And how do you deal with it when you're coaching and talking with your clients?
That's a good question. I'm going to answer that two ways. The first way I'm going to answer it, because it's a call about our research service, I'm just going to talk about it from a research standpoint, and then we'll sort of double back into the client. And if you're an advisor, how you handle it. But from a research standpoint, I mean, we're really upfront. We're saying we're buying individual equities or stocks that we think can double over the next 2 to 3 years. And I think what most people don't realize, I know you mentioned the last year, the 100% thing being an aberration, not so much, Andrew. Every year, there are securities that double, every single year.
Right.
Depending on how good the market is, you know, it could be a handful or a few handful, but there are securities that double every single year. As a matter of fact, there are a handful of securities even that we follow that are up threefold last year. And if you just do the math, it doesn't take many of those winners, you know, for you to really do well. So again, for our clients that are creating or building wealth, you know, getting these growth, these high growth equities that can double really can do a lot to your net worth and really contract those years you need to be saving for retirement. And I think that's something that we tend to miss when we just index all the time, that we're always going to be average. Yeah. We're never going to have any doubles or triples.
Right.
So from a research standpoint, that's just kind of what we're looking for. The volatility itself and the sell-offs actually, believe it or not, are really beneficial. You know, most people shouldn't be investing in the equity markets anyway if they don't have 5 to 7 years to put the money to work. And so if you have a really crummy period, you know, it's like a rubber band that stretches. The further you pull it back, when you let it go, the velocity is going to be really, really high. And that's typically what you see. You talked about, you know, quarter four, 2018, but then you have to fast forward to quarter one, 2019. Mm-hmm. A lot of those securities that sold off the most in Q4, at least the good ones, were the ones that came back the fastest in Q1 of 2019. So that's what I would say. On the client side, when we're doing from a wealth management standpoint, you're right. A lot of it is on the front end, on education. And a lot of these portfolios are actually customized. And so you're looking at liquidity. Hey, if a client's going to need money over the next 6 to 12 months, you're going to husband that cash to the side. You're going to have to make sure that you have enough fixed and predictable income-based securities that you can sell off. So you make sure over the next 3 or 4 years you're not, you know, selling any security that you're waiting for long-term gains from. So there's some management that goes along with it. And then there's also some education. But, you know, what we found is we've had really good success talking to clients, explaining the process, you know, explaining the volatility. But, you know, I think our clients, you know, anybody with significant net worth, you know, these are smart people. They have common sense. They understand sort of the volatility and the accumulation part of it. And, you know, I think when they see gains in their portfolio, particularly, you'll be amazed, you know, a lot of clients have been investing for decades and they just have never seen significant gains. Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing. We sit down with the client and do a review after a couple of years and show them a couple of securities in their account that have went up 80 or 90% and they're just tickled pink. They've never seen anything like that in their life.
I got to tell you, obviously the last year, even more than that, and even this year for that matter, has been a pretty spectacular year for a lot of individual securities. What's interesting, though, is in one of the strategies that we manage, so we use a quantitative filtering process, and tell me if any of this sounds maybe either familiar or something that you can shed some light on, okay? So we have this process where we go through and we take a, you know, broad base of equities out there, thousands of equities, and we put it through this filtering and screening process, and we're looking for a variety of different growth factors. A lot of them are consistency of growth. And things like where we can see that year over year on a quarter over quarter basis, We're seeing that there's growth of earnings, growth of revenue. We're seeing margin expansion, a lot of things, you know, a lot of good things that go into that kind of screening process to find good quality stocks, okay, with good growth potential. So far, so good, right?
Yes.
Now, one of the things that I've noticed is over the last year and change, let's say, well, that screen has gone from about 60 stocks that have come through that screen to when I saw it yesterday, it's 28.
Ooh, okay.
So now I have a couple of choices, right? You know, and this is over time, this has been a similar situation I've seen before. One, say, well, let's loosen it up, right? Let's loosen up the characteristics of the screen. I'm like, no, I don't think we want to do that. Second, I could say, well, what's happening there? Well, it's a different time. You know, now we have low interest rates and throw in whatever you want to have in the backdrop, okay? Mm-hmm. But it is a concern to me, and I don't know if you're seeing this as well, that stocks in terms of on a fundamental basis, on core fundamentals, earnings, revenues, ROE, margin, you know, even some trading issues that go on. What is going on? I don't know if you're finding this, but we're finding less and less stocks to find out there.
You know what? I'm not surprised on the one hand. If you just go back a decade or so, there are fewer stocks that are out there, especially publicly traded stocks that you or I would be looking at. And part of that has to do with private equity itself. You know, if you take a look at the amount of capital that they control, you add in the leverage and the fact that institutions keep giving them money because the last 15 years has been one of the best performing asset classes at plus 20%. You know, you have a lot of these private equity firms that, you know, do public to private. Well, they'll go in, they'll take a publicly traded company, and now it's private. They just did one 2 weeks ago with Anixter, the big wire distribution company. And that's been happening, you know, over the last decade or so. And then, you know, is stuff like Sarbanes-Oxley and more of these regulations, it's very expensive to be public. So if you take a look at just the quantity of publicly traded companies that exist, there are fewer today than there have been. So on the one hand, it wouldn't surprise me if you have fewer things coming.
But I'm talking about from last year, a year ago till now, we cut the list in half.
Yep. The other thing I would say, we're not finding any fewer of them. But again, I don't know what thing you're going through. The one thing we are finding is prices are up. So if you have all of those sort of metrics in there and you've got price as a governor, that might be an issue because the very superior businesses have been priced higher. We have noticed that on our side. So we're not finding fewer of them. We may find fewer of them that are reasonably priced, particularly when the market goes up and the screens fill. When the market goes down, there's just as many attractive businesses, but they're more attractively priced. So I would agree with you as it relates to price, but quality of businesses themselves, we're finding just some fantastic businesses.
Yeah, I'm not saying we're not finding good ones. I'm just saying we're finding less that are meeting a strict criteria. And I don't even think this criteria is too strict of saying we want to have growth of earnings and growth of EPS and growth of, for example, growth of revenue. I mean, you know, what we're finding, obviously, we are seeing a little bit of a drop down in some companies in terms of their year-over-year earnings or, you know, net earnings, you know, that we've seen on for them. But I have to look at that. We look at it constantly, and I'm constantly scratching my head. But, you know, you do mention a couple of things that are interesting, that stock prices you mentioned. What is going on with the split world? We used to have splits back in the day. What happened? When's the last time you remember like a split? Like, there it is. It was like Apple was the last split I remember.
Yes, I don't think it's cool to split anymore. You know, I think Berkshire Hathaway started it, and Washington Post continued it, but now you got Amazon priced at almost 2,000. I don't think that there's any pride in the stock split anymore. I don't think that's it. But I'm going to go back to one thing you said before about you finding less and less businesses. One of the things you mentioned is when you do your screens is those earnings per share. I'll remind you. Remember last year, Andrew, it wasn't an earnings growth year.
Right.
It was a multiple expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of businesses that we find, at least the most attractive ones, don't have positive reported earnings per share. Now, they are profitable on a non-GAAP basis, but the EPS is a GAAP number. And after the accounting standards changed, that changed. And so if your filter is just for EPS, you're going to leave a lot of the great businesses out. just because of how they operate and how the accounting works.
Yeah. And that could be one of the things, or, you know, we're just a little bit too stringent on some of the things. It's also the other possibility there. But I hear you. So obviously you have to look at, as you mentioned, pricing issues. And we did see this multiple expansion last year without a lot of growth of earnings. And a lot of the growth of earnings from the previous year going into it was really not, I would say, holistic, but rather due to the change in the tax code, right? So then we also have a lot of earnings growth due to the buybacks that are going on. I mean, I saw a study recently that said that Goldman Sachs estimated that 2020 there'd be about $450 billion worth of buybacks, bringing stock back into, you know, putting money to the market, bringing stock back on the open market. But yet, you know, like $30 or $40 billion of retail in bringing money in, and then I think another 20 or 30 from, you know, sovereigns and things like that. So in this time, while there are great companies, I get that. So let's just kind of pause and get that as a baseline. Do you look at, well, there's maybe a little euphoria here or not? Or do you look at any kind of market timing issues? Or you're just saying, hey, you know what? Great company. We buy it today. We buy it next week or next month. Unless things change, still a great company. It doesn't really matter.
No, you're right. We're sensitive to all of those factors. And one of the things we didn't mention up front, we're fundamentally, you're right, a fundamental shop, and we're bottoms up. But we're also, we consider ourselves actually a multi-factor shop. We do start from the bottom up. We start with fundamentals. But we have a technical screen. We take every security through. And we also have a quant screen. And so something must be attractive for us on all three fronts, fundamental, technical, and quant, mm-hmm. In order for us to start that process I told you about earlier, where we send a name off, we get a quick look done on it from an analyst, it comes back long form, that sort of thing. So we do have, it's not just, you know, hey, this company's a good company, let me go buy it. We're sensitive to how it's trading, how it's moved recently. And then valuation for us, I don't want to say, so we're less stringent on valuation. So we have a valuation range, and the names that we look at, Andrew, at least on the equity side, are growthy names. And so we know we're going to be paying a premium. You know, we're not paying 2x sales or 1.5x book for these names. Generally, they're premium businesses. On average, the revenue growth is 25% plus. They're getting ready to be profitable on some level. They're generally category killers. And there's generally a founder, CEO, owner. So we know that there's alignment of interest. These are best in breed businesses. And typically, we're not getting them cheap. But we are sensitive to valuation. We don't want to pay, we want to pay premium prices, but not nosebleed through the roof prices. And but, you know, we're not buying the stocks that we're buying, you wouldn't consider cheap.
So one of the ones you sent me here, you sent me a very exhaustive and intricate discussion about Roku. This was done back in October of 2019. I don't know if it's still on your list as a buy, but you had a buy recommendation at that point.
Yes.
And lots of nice colors and graphs and conversation and these little indenting things like your grab and go talking points, which I guess you're trademarking grab and go. If you get that trademark, yeah, let me know. I'll be pretty impressed. but, you know, kind of going through this whole thing, you go with, you know, you have a lot of, I think, very easy to understand commentary here. So Roku was something that I looked at as well. We liked the name, although the volatility was a little rough. Frankly, we shorted it when it kind of peaked out and made, I think it was about a 22% gain on the short side of it real quick. It was more of a technical side of trading versus the fundamentals for us, because we also saw, from what I saw, was that the potential for a lot of competition out there. Now, they are saturating, and they are clearly, you know, up there, because I think a lot of people think that Roku is only, like, if you go to the store and buy the Roku device versus Roku being embedded. You follow what I'm saying?
I get you, yes.
I think there's a lot of people that don't really understand that Roku is embedded as in smart TVs. And that is the part of the OS that they utilize for their channel hopping, we'll call it, and for their subscription services. And Roku gets a piece when you sign up through a Roku gets a piece of the subscription, right?
Correct.
So that's the kind of model right there. Are you still bullish on Roku?
We are a lot. A few things I'll clear up for you and mention along the way. First off, congratulations to you on your short for Roku, making a quick 22%. I wouldn't suggest you doing that too often, particularly with this name. So you should pat yourself on the back. It was great timing and very fortuitous for whoever that pulled the trigger on that. So congrats. But yeah, here's the way that we look at the business. I'll give you a way that we sort of analyze and think about it, and then what we think of the story. You're right. I think most people don't really fully understand the Roku story, and we didn't either. I mean, we did a first pass 18 months or so ago, and we just kind of ho-hummed it as being neutral. And we did our first pass at 50. So our systems, Jarvis, picked up Roku very, very quickly. But when we went through, we thought about it like you did. Hey, we thought about the streaming stick. They compete with Chromecast, the Fire from Amazon, and the rest of that. And really what we didn't get is the fact that Roku really is getting ready to be the operating system for your television. So if you think of the top three televisions that sold in the U.S. and that just sold for Christmas, they were all Chinese brands, and they all ran on the Roku operating system. And if you think about, connecting or streaming and the cheapest way to stream things, it's through television. It isn't your cell phone. It isn't your computer. Mm-hmm. You can get a big screen TV now for about $200. And if you're manufacturing TVs, price becomes a really big issue. And you need a smart TV, to really be competitive. And if you don't have to, if you can just license the operating system from Roku already, you know, that $15 or $20 it'll save you on a bill of goods can be the difference between your television set being in Best Buy or Walmart or not. So it's a really big deal. And once you sign on to the TV, you automatically are going to sign in to a Roku account. That's going to happen automatically. And really, they just sell those sticks just to get the accounts. And really what they want is accounts for each and every person that watch TV. Eventually, all the television we watch, it's all going to be streamed, and it's all going to be streamed on Roku. And if you think about sort of the streaming, I know there was a lot made last fall about Netflix and the competition coming from Disney Plus and from Apple TV Plus.
Let's not forget about Peacock, the most exciting streaming ever.
Yes, it's not too late, right? Not too late. But if you think about all these streaming services that people worry about, are they going to be competition for Netflix? Who cares? The more the better for Roku, because all of those platforms are launched through Roku. And you're right. Roku, you mentioned the cut that they get off subscriptions. That's peanuts. Really, what they're going to do really well is the advertising. You know, if you think about the, you know, some of the biggest companies that operate in the stock market, be like Amazon and Facebook and Google and not Amazon, but Facebook and Google. Amazon is just starting to get into ad revenue. But Facebook and Google, you know, the reason that they're so huge is because of their advertising revenue. And what Roku has is whatever advertiser wants. It knows you personally, knows your viewing habits and your buying habits, and it can advertise to you directly. That's worth a lot.
You know what's disturbing about this, though? So if you go back in time where we had just 10 channels and you had to, like, sit through the commercials, there was no VCR to record anything. You know, you kind of dealt with it. You got free TV, but you had you'd got advertisement, right? Fast forward to cable, you paid for it, but there was no advertisements, right? Remember that?
Yep.
Then we fast forward even further, and now we have cable with mixed advertisements for some things that you're paying for and premium channels that don't have advertisements. Now we're going to premium channels that you pay for and have advertisements too. You know?
Yeah. Yes.
Very disturbing for the viewer. Or, no, forget it. To me. Just to me.
Well, that's where we are. And I think for the consumer, they've made the decision that they want free and that they'll give up advertising and privacy in order to do it. Think about the internet. Think about Gmail. Think about Android phones. I mean, the consumer has made that decision, whether you like it or not. And certainly Roku is a part of that. But advertisers are coming, unlike the current days, you know, advertising is a really big $700 billion advertising market. Most of it's done, you know, on television. And it's the old saying about advertisers: they know what half is working, just not what half. Mm-hmm. But now, everything happens digitally. They know when you click. They know when you're watching. They know what you buy. They know your spending listening habits. It's a very valuable piece of real estate for advertisers. And we're just, it's just starting. And Roku is going to be the prime beneficiary. So we don't just look at it for a today thing. And it's going to be a while for people to understand the story. Once they understand the story, you're looking at a business that's not going to be trading at 12 times future sales. You're looking at a business that's probably going to be trading at 20 times future sales. You know, at the same time, you get revenue growth north of 50%. And you're talking about a business that's going to be free cash flow positive this year in fiscal year 2021. So, and they're the leader in the clubhouse. You mentioned competition. There is no competition for over-the-top streaming channels, not in this way. So think about them as being a mix between, Comcast. Think about them being just the Comcast, I guess, of streaming TV. I guess that's a good way to think about.
Right. But now let me ask you this question, though. So all that good stuff, all that great stuff, what if, from your perspective, I'm talking about your perspective, you have all this nailed down and you have this belief and understanding of the fundamentals, the story, all that, right? Yes. What happens if the stock starts to, well, for whatever reason, unbeknownst to anybody, trade off? And it continues trading off for, let's just say, I don't know, 6 months or a year. I don't know what the time frame is. You know, the stock is cut down by 30%. I don't wish that on you. But if it does and whatever, do you change your investment outlook? Or, you know, obviously, if nothing changes but markets cause problems, I understand that that's nothing, creates opportunity. But, you know, if there is something going on, because sometimes, you know, stock prices lead reality of what goes on. What would make you change your mind about this besides another competitor coming in right off the top?
So it would have to be something fundamental, and we would pretty much ignore price. I mean, I think one of the things that I lament during my day is at some point I have to check prices. I'd like to check the news on the individual businesses, just not the price, because a lot of times there is no basis in reality. But we would pay attention to the fundamentals a lot. I mean, there's not anything that happens with the business that we're not aware of. We love the CEO, Anthony Wood, who, by the way, was an old Netflix alum, long story. But we love the management there. We love the strategic vision and the business. We would pay attention to the business fundamentals. And if the business fundamentals changed, it wouldn't matter what was going on with the price, particularly if they changed in a negative way. We'd look to do something. I mean, we'd reevaluate the position. And the opposite of that is true. If the business just kept getting better, and we wouldn't pay attention too much to the price. As a matter of fact, we'd hope the business was getting better and the price was getting worse, because we know eventually those two have to come back together again. And so that doesn't bother us. It wouldn't bother us at all. Again, we're long-term shareholders of a similar business for streaming, Netflix, as a firm that's been, in the history of investments, it's been our biggest winner. We started buying the shares back in 2011 when they were splitting off the streaming from the CD business, and they were creating something called Quixtor back in 2011 when the shares went from 300 to 60, pre-adjusted for the 7-for-1 split. And so we're familiar with volatility in shares. We're familiar with streaming businesses and how they operate, and we're comfortable with it. And I think every client of the firm has had some shares of Netflix along the way, you know, over some time, and they get sort of comfortable with it as well. So I just think it's going to be a wonderful business. Hey, look, this business is a $15 billion enterprise value. We think in a few years, this thing's going to be a $100 billion business.
Wow. Now, that's significant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think it's going to be a stretch to get there. We just hope that they don't get purchased beforehand.
Mm. Well, it's always possible, especially with valuations of what they are today. Low interest rates are what they are today, too. So good stuff. Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you and mention that we will have ways to access and find you, Noland Langford, Left Brain Investment Research, on the show notes for episode number 645. For thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go over there. We'll put some information on where you can actually get to him on both his hedge fund side of things and wealth management, as well as the investment research side. So, hey, I appreciate you coming on board today. Lots of great information. That's been a great time.
Thanks for having us. And yeah, the listeners can find us at leftbrainir.com. And for any of your listeners that like to subscribe to our service, we are offering a free 30-day subscription.
Oh, I like bargains and deals. I didn't even press you for that. Bad me. Yeah, bad me.
Yeah, no worries. It's just only for listeners of your show.
Okay. Oh, so that means we're not going to put on site. So if you're listening, you can go over there. And what do they have to do to get that?
Yeah, it's just leftbrainir.com. Just sign up for the basic membership.
Yeah.
And we're turning it on for free. In the checkout code, just put Horowitz, your last name.
Perfect.
And that'll enable them to get a 30-day subscription, basic subscription to the research service.
All right, great. I appreciate that. That's great stuff. And I'll prompt that in the beginning. Horowitz is code and free 30 days. All right, appreciate it. That's great. Thank you for that. I that was not pre-planned. So thanks so much for that. That's great.
No worries.
All right, Nolan, well,
thanks
have a
good
for
day. Having me. It's a wonderful show, and Happy New Year, my friend.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Thank you. There you go, a freebie in the offering that I was not aware of. A nice surprise for listeners. Check that out. We'll put the information on how to get to Left Brain Research over on the Disciplined Investor show notes for the episode number 645. We're going to end it there. We're going to cut it. We're going to kind of put the kibosh to the time frame that we're now occupying for the show this week. I want to thank you for joining me, and I will see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.